From Philadelphia, today, Amtrak and infrastructure. From Facebook, news articles, straight to you, no clicking necessary. And from Chicago, one of the guys who invented behavioral economics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 13th of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We begin in Philadelphia, where the train that derailed last night was going more than 100 miles an hour, twice the speed for which the track at that spot was rated. So said the National Transportation Safety Board today, and investigators are still trying to figure out exactly what happened. While at the same time, a bit farther south on the very busy Northeast Corridor down in Washington, D.C., Congress was coincidentally chewing over and, in fact, cutting Amtrak's budget. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts us off.
Ride an Amtrak train from Washington to New York, and you'll notice a lot of clickety-clacking. It's not a smooth ride. In fact, Amtrak says it has a $52 billion maintenance backlog on its Northeast Corridor. Sean Jeans-Gale is a spokesman for the National Association of Railroad Passengers. He sat in the House Appropriations Committee hearing on Amtrak funding today, wishing the committee would open the purse strings a little. It didn't.
There was a lot of hand-wringing where they said, "We all know this is inadequate, but there's nothing much we can do."
The committee members said their hands were tied by spending caps. So is Amtrak's Northeast Corridor safe?
I would characterize it as safe.
That's Joseph Sussman, who teaches and researches rail transportation at MIT. And yes, he was about to say, but...
But there's also the question of what quality of service is offered.
Like trains are late if they have to slow down to go over rough track. Sussman would like to see not just track maintenance, but sections of track good enough for high-speed rail. Mark Burton teaches transportation and economics at the University of Tennessee. He says if you wanted to run high-speed trains along the whole Northeast Corridor, you'd have to spend billions.
You'd need to invest in it from one end to the other. There would almost certainly be no section of track that was unaffected.
The entire budget for Amtrak in today's House bill, just over $1 billion, $262 million less than last year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The media news of this Wednesday comes to us, as things so often do now, online. Facebook has worked out a deal with 9 content companies, the New York Times and BuzzFeed among them, that will let those companies publish articles directly on Facebook instead of just providing a link to their own websites. What this means for you and me is that we can get to those articles faster. And yes, we are just talking maybe a couple of seconds faster. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports, time is money, you know.
As we all know, there's a lot of important information on the internet that we demand to see quickly. Well, that's a baby sloth, but...
I feel happy of myself.
That's a little boy learning how to ride a bike. But we still demand to see these things now or not at all.
You really only have about 3 seconds for a web page to load fully before the person's gone.
That's Sean Work, director of inbound marketing at Kiss Metrics. They track customer data online for sites like Netflix and Hulu.
For certain businesses, it has a profound effect on their bottom line.
In Facebook's case, if a page takes too long to load, people either won't go to it or they'll exit the Facebook app and open it in some other browser. In either case, Facebook misses out on important data.
How long you spent on the article? Did you read half of it and go away from it? Did you watch any of the multimedia or the videos?
Deborah Aja Williamson is principal analyst at eMarketer. That information is important for advertisers and for Facebook to give people more content they want to click on. And if that content is hosted on Facebook servers,
it really makes it possible for people to just stay in that happy little Facebook universe that Facebook has built.
So ultimately, getting content in front of people faster keeps people in front of Facebook longer. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today never quite got in gear. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. While you go on Instagram to look at celebrity selfies or food or whatever it is you choose to look at on Instagram, there are doctors on a different photo sharing app looking at gangrene and gallstones and rashes of all kinds. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman has more on what is being called Instagram for Doctors.
First-year emergency medicine resident John Corker has just uploaded a photo. It's of a fresh red and greenish wound on the top of a right foot.
Oh, man, that looks very painful.
And it was for the patient. What you're looking at here is a badly infected foot that has to be continually washed out by surgery.
He posted this keepsake through a free photo-sharing app called Figure One. Sitting on a bench outside of Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Corker scrolls down below the image to reveal...
So let's see here. It was starred by a number of people, meaning they appreciated the image.
It's an odd thing to appreciate, but hundreds of thousands of people have created an account on Figure One. Most are nurses or doctors who, like Corker, post and review photos to learn about medical conditions and share the occasionally gruesome photo. The x-rays, lesions, tumors, and gunshot wounds are categorized by anatomy and specialty. Corker says in the emergency room, access to these images is invaluable.
If I'm able to log on to Instagram or Figure One and see a picture of something that I learned about 3 years ago in medical school that I may see in the future that if I don't recognize in the first 30 minutes of care could be harmful to the patient, that's really helpful for my learning going forward.
Unlike Instagram, Figure One requires users to remove all personal details, think faces or birthmarks, from the photos they post.
The best way to keep a secret is not to have it.
Joshua Landy, a 34-year-old critical care doctor in Toronto, co-founded Figure One.
We give them all the tools they need to be able to remove any potentially private details from the photo. There's an automatic face blocking tool that blocks out faces.
Tools to block out names, dates, and tattoos. Once the photo is submitted, Landy's team reviews it before giving the final go-ahead. He says they encourage all users to get patient consent.
However, they're not restricted to using our consent form. They're permitted to use the consent form from their jurisdiction. Some hospitals require it to be done on paper, and some hospitals require it to be done just using voices instead of having it done on paper.
Now, if you're thinking all this photo snapping and sharing is new, well, it's not. Classic textbooks are teeming with images of guts and brains spliced and splayed in professional lighting. In some specialties, like dermatology, photos are especially useful.
Our specialty is very visual.
Dr. Simal Desai is founder of Innovative Dermatology in Plano, Texas.
We diagnose and treat based on seeing, feeling, examining the skin, looking for rashes, looking for color, looking for abnormalities. And so pictures inherently are a daily part of our practice.
As medical file sharing and photo sharing become ubiquitous, Desai has a few words of advice to doctors about to hit upload.
Always keep in the back of your mind, is what I'm doing in the best interest of the patient, and is this actually going to help the outcome of my patient? And if the answer to either of those is no, then you know you don't need to be involved in it.
Oh, and by the way, if you want to peruse the archives of Figure One, you don't have to be a doctor or a nurse. Lurkers are allowed. In fact, nearly 10% of Figure One users are not in healthcare. You can't comment, but you can admire close-ups of busted lips and green, glistening gallstones to your heart's content. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
We talk a whole lot about economics on this program, about this or that economic indicator or theory or economist, but there is a case to be made. Actually, it's not like there's any doubt about it at all, so you don't have to make the case. The most significant input to any economic decision is us, people, humans, and the not always rational ways that we make economic decisions. It's a field known as behavioral economics, one of the leading practitioners of which, one of the pioneers, really, is a guy by the name of Richard Thaler. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, and his new book about the subject at hand is called Misbehaving. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I'm going to start you on the second chapter of this book, the first couple of sentences, and I want to ask you about them. You say, and this is a quote, "I began to have deviant thoughts about economic theory while I was a graduate student." Take me back to those days. What was it like in economics when you started thinking, you know what, maybe we're missing something here?
You know, I was always asking my professors, really? You know, is that really what you think people do? And they said, shut up and, you know, do your problem sets. My thesis topic was the value of a human life.
Yeah.
I asked people a question. I said, suppose you had some risk, 1 in 1,000 risk of dying. How much would you pay to eliminate it? People would give one answer, say $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, how much would you have to be paid to take an extra 1 in 1,000 risk of death? And they'd say, well, I wouldn't do that at all, or I would demand $1 million. Well, economic theory says the answers to those two questions should be basically the same. And they were like way different. I said, oh, that's interesting. And then I just started collecting stuff like that.
You're not alone in behavioral economics, right? I mean, you know, Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel for it a number of years ago, right? So you're not the only guy. But the question is, why did it take economists, oh, I don't know, 250 years since Adam Smith to figure out that people do wacky stuff?
Well, you know, the thing is, Adam Smith was a behavioral economist. Before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote a book called Theory of Moral Sentiments. And he had stuff like self-control in there, a very controversial topic, one of the things I've studied. Then what happened is, in the 1940s, economics started getting highly mathematical. And it was basically because economists weren't smart enough to write down models of real behavior that they started writing down models of highly rational behavior. And then they kind of forgot about humans until annoying people like Danny Kahneman and I came around and started saying, really?
What happens when, as frequently happens with academic economists, businesses come to you and say, listen, can you consult for us and help us figure out what we're doing or you know, how to do it better?
My very first consulting job was when I was at Cornell University. There was a local ski area there, and they were in big trouble. And we devised some pricing schemes to help them get revenue in earlier. So one of the things we did is we sold people a 10-pack for 40% off, but they had to buy it by October 15th. People love these things because they're saving money. 40% off. Wow, that's a deal. And then we realized after 2 or 3 years of doing this that they were only using about 60% of the tickets.
Hmm.
So we were basically selling these tickets at full price and getting the money before October 15th. But I don't think we were ripping anybody off.
No, you're just it's the human frailties, right? I mean, you know.
Well, we were just giving them a deal, and it was up to them. It was up to them how much they wanted to ski. If we hadn't done that, there would have been no ski resort.
How much does your livelihood and really your career, and this is going to sound like a terrible and boorish question, but how much does it depend on people not being economically sophisticated?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've made a living by pointing out that the emperor doesn't have much clothes on. But I'm not worried about all of a sudden everybody turning into Einstein. And that wouldn't be enough. They'd have to be some combination of Einstein and Gandhi. So, yeah, my career depends on there being humans. When we're replaced by robots, then I won't have anything to do.
Richard Thaler. At the Chicago Booth School of Business, his book is called Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. Professor Thaler, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me on.
Coming up.
The floor is red like ketchup, and it has a squiggle of mustard going down the center of it.
Oh, I wish I was an Oscar. Oh, no, I don't want to give it away. So instead, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 7 points today. That's less than a 0.1%, finished at 18,060. The NASDAQ up 5 points, a 0.1%, finished things at 4,981. The S&P 500, we'll call it basically unchanged, closed at 2,098. Tough day for retailers out there. Macy's moved down 2.4%. The nation's biggest department store chain reported worse than expected first quarter earnings. It blamed bad winter weather on the East Coast and product delays at ports on the West Coast. Got it coming and going, I guess. Clothier Ralph Lauren, or Ralph Lauren, I am never, ever sure, dropped 3%. The clothing and accessories chain Fossil dug down 0.2% today. Qualcomm clicked up 1.3%. The chipmaker plans to tap the corporate bond market for the first time and use the proceeds for, among other things, financing some acquisitions. Speaking of acquisitions, Owens Illinois rallied 9.2%. Beer and wine bottle maker is buying a glass container business from the Mexican firm Vitro. Vitro glided up 20%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.29%. Remember our story from yesterday on bonds, y'all. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its April Producer Price Index. The House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on protecting consumers, financial data security in the age of computer hackers. And 17 years ago, on May 14, 1998, after 9 seasons, the series finale of Seinfeld aired. Where would we be without Festivus? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Still having a drought out here in California. No new water coming that we know of, which means pretty much everything is on the table, including the state's first-come, first-served system of water rights. Regulators are set to issue curtailment orders to some of the most privileged water users in California, those with what are called senior water rights, rights claimed before the permitting process was set up back in 1914. Those folks usually don't have much to worry about when it comes to water. But as Sarah Gardner reports now from the sustainability desk, 4 years of drought, yeah, that changes everything.
In the wacky world of California water rights, it's good to show up early. The folks that stuck their straws in the river before 1914 are the last in line for cuts in dry years. Water rights scholar Buzz Thompson at Stanford says California's now reached the back of the line.
California's drought has now gone on for a long enough period of time, and it's bad enough that it looks like we might actually shut off our senior most water right holders.
The last time that happened was the late 70s. Jerry Brown was governor then, too. UC Berkeley's Michael Hanneman says it rained the next year, so the cuts didn't last long. But he says state water regulators didn't enforce the cuts much either.
They didn't sue, or they had no authority to levy fines. So it was an extreme form of jawboning.
Water Board spokesman Tim Moran said today the board can issue fines and has beefed up enforcement recently, but some rural irrigation districts with senior rights may sue over the expected cutbacks. They'd argue in part California has no authority over them because their rights predate the state water board. But Stanford's Buzz Thompson says California regulators do have other powers.
They do have the authority to prevent unauthorized diversions of water and also to prevent unreasonable uses of water.
And exactly what's unreasonable may depend on exactly how bad this drought gets. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The Affordable Care Act is 5 years old this year, and since it was signed, more than 10 million people who were without health insurance now have it. The catch is that most people still do have to pay something for the care that they get, and many people can't. From Northwest Public Radio, Rowan Moore-Garrity has more on the still widespread problem of medical debt.
At the Yakima County Courthouse, presiding District Court Judge Kevin Roy walks past a rattling dot matrix printer and long rows of color-coded folders to a shelf of files awaiting his signature.
If I was to pull this file out, let's see. Memorial Physicians, PLLC. That's not just by luck.
Judge Roy says most of these files are for medical debt. He spends a big chunk of his workday signing judgments against people who owe money to hospitals and medical providers.
It's like the tide coming in every week.
Medical debt affects one of every four Americans and accounts for more than half of all bankruptcies. At age 60, Scott Clyatt is in debt for the first time in his life. Chronic pancreatitis has forced him to stop working, and it regularly sends him to the emergency room for a week at a time. He now has free health coverage through Obamacare, but he's still struggling to pay off old debt. Missing a single $25 installment landed Clyatt in court.
The judge did allow me to speak, but the fact that I admitted that I do owe them money kind of cut everything else off.
Most of Clyatt's bills were forgiven through the hospital's charity care program, but he's barely made a dent in the remainder, things like a $4,000 ambulance ride.
Divide $4,000 by $25, my grandkids will probably still be working on it when I'm gone.
Overall, gaps in coverage like Clyatt's are the exception to the rule. The vast majority of people with medical debt have insurance the whole time those costs are piling up. But the bills insurance doesn't cover can be devastating on their own. That's one reason Steffi Woolhandler says health insurance is often, in her words, a defective product.
People buy it in good faith to try to get medical care and make sure their bills are paid. And then when they get an extensive or prolonged illness, the health insurance doesn't work.
Woolhandler teaches health policy at City University of New York. She says even with Obamacare, many policies still have high out-of-pocket costs. Karen Politz co-authored a recent study on medical debt for the Kaiser Family Foundation.
We see a lot of plans still that have, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 deductibles, and that's still way more than most Americans have on hand.
In those circumstances, Politz says an illness is often the beginning of a cascade of financial problems. Scott Clyatt feels his medical debts are undoing a lifetime of hard work.
I have a hard time with this in that I've always paid my bills. Bankruptcy is that wall that I just don't want to hit yet.
That's a predicament Clyatt shares with millions of others. In Yakima, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity for Marketplace.
We've been doing a quick series on first jobs the past couple of weeks, and some of them are exactly what you would think a first job would be. Fry cook at a fast food chain, sales associate someplace, or maybe a telemarketer or something, I don't know. Some first jobs, though, are anything but typical.
My name is Natasha Best, and my first job was a hot dogger, also known as a Wienermobile driver.
My hot dog has a first name. It's O-S-C-A-R.
The biggest, most exciting piece of it was, of course, the fact that I was going to be touring the country. So it was a giant road trip. We spanned and crisscrossed back and forth the Midwestern section of the country. It's pretty easy to drive, and it has a really good turning radius. The inside is just so much fun. The floor is red like ketchup, and it has a squiggle of mustard going down the center of it. The ceiling, it looks like the sky, so it's blue and white with big fluffy clouds, and overall it's just a happy place. We hand out wiener whistles, which is a little takeaway. It's a whistle in the shape of the Wienermobile, and it's been around for years and years and years. Some people have wiener whistles dating back to the 50s and 60s. We would park somewhere, and we would just get inundated. People wanting to see the inside of it, look at it. But then I'd even have people come up to me and ask for my autograph or ask to take a photo with me. They just loved it. I got to understand how our country lives, who they are, what our true culture is. That, to me, was the most valuable piece of my experience. If they see it or they hear it, They get a smile on their face, and that's the point.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is what I truly like to be. 'Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer wiener,
welcome for that earworm. It's going to be with you all afternoon. Natasha's adventures in the Wienermobile were featured in the book First Jobs, which was edited by Merritt Watts. Today, by the way, Natasha works at a PR firm in New York City. This final note on the way out today, it's obviously still up in the air how long Amtrak is going to be out of business or, at best, running reduced service on that Northeast corridor. But here is a quick hint as to how important that New York to Washington run is for the company. Amtrak made $286 million there last year. All of its other long-distance routes, all of them put together, Amtrak lost more than $600 million. Okay, we're off. The Dow off 7 points today. That's less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 5. That's a 10%. The S&P 500, we'll call it basically unchanged. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will be here tomorrow, I promise. Well, I promise maybe. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.